Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, a Friday conversation, heavy on music, with Steve Earle. But first, human rights groups and many of President Obama's most ardent supporters are both infuriated and puzzled today about his plans to revive the Bush-era military commission system that he once railed against. His supporters say the president is breaking a campaign pledge. Here's detainee lawyer Christine Husky.
Obama campaigned sort of under the promise and on the platform that the military commissions were terrible and that's not what the Bush administration should have done. So I think just from a purely political perspective, he's kind of breaking a promise.
The president had suspended all military tribunals for terrorist suspects until May 20th. Today he's asking for another 120-day delay to revamp the system, to keep it but make some changes. Julian Barnes is Pentagon reporter for the LA Times. And Julian, you know, on the campaign trail, President Obama did describe the Guantanamo trials as a flawed military commission system. So is this a reversal for him?
The White House last night was trying to convince people it was not a reversal, but common sense kind of leads you to believe that it is. He made very clear he was going to use federal courts and courts martials. That's what he said on the campaign trail. But once they got into office and started looking at these cases, they saw that some of this was very complicated.
Well, so far, the commission system has yielded just 3 convictions in 8 years. Charges are pending against 21 other detainees, but there are more than 200 other detainees awaiting their future. So the commission system hasn't worked that well. What were the complications that convinced the Obama administration they had to stick with it?
There are 2 main reasons they're going to stick with the military commissions. One is hearsay evidence. There are rules against using that in federal courts, and they are going to change the rules for military commissions, but you're still going to be able to use some of that, and they thought that was important to convict. There's also issues like the Miranda rule. None of these detainees were ever given warnings that confessions could be used against them. That may or may not present a problem in federal court. In the military commissions, they would not.
So the president is saying he's going to revive the system, but with changes. Can you just list what we know about what those changes might be?
Sure. He is going to restrict further the use of any coerced evidence. He is going to change the rules on hearsay evidence, making it a little more difficult to use the hearsay evidence. He's also going to let detainees have more latitude in picking their own lawyer to represent them. And he's also, in this next 120 days, inviting Congress to make any other changes they might want to the law or to suggest things he can do by executive order. So there may be further changes, but the coerced evidence, the hearsay evidence, and the lawyers are the major rules.
Well, is he completely going to work with the military tribunals, or might his administration still use some federal courts?
No, it's not completely the military commissions. They're going to try to move a lot of these cases to the federal courts. We don't know the exact number, and I don't think they know the exact number on the military commissions. But where there is evidence that they can use in the federal courts, they are going to do that. And I think, from what I'm hearing, we probably can expect the 9/11 masterminds, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, to be brought to federal court.
Well, the president has made other decisions in recent days that have upset his supporters. For instance, withholding photos depicting alleged abuse of detainees by U.S. soldiers. He's saying they can't be made public because it might endanger troops that are in the field. So how are these decisions likely to affect the president politically?
Talking to some of Obama's allies, they make the point that he is going to have to make some other unpopular decisions, particularly around Guantanamo, in the months to come when he tries to move more of these detainees to the United States, when he faces decisions on releasing some of them into the United States and into other countries. And when he makes those kinds of decisions that are going to be attacked from the right, he is going to need vigorous support from his friends on the left. And if they are angry about his military commissions, they may not defend him as rigorously as he might need.
Julian Barnes, Pentagon correspondent for the LA Times, speaking to us about President Obama's decision to revive the Bush-era military tribunal system for detainees with some changes. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it's Friday. Let's give ourselves a little break from the news with some terrific music and a reminder of a terrific music man, singer-songwriter Townes Van Zandt. He once said he thought his life would run out before his work did, that he had designed it that way. He was right. After years battling depression and addiction, Van Zandt died at the age of 52 in 1997. But his hard-bitten, eloquent songs, like this one, Live to Fly, live on.
Won't say I love you, babe. Won't say I need you, babe. But I'm gonna get you, babe, and I will not do you wrong.
Bob Dylan, Emmylou Harris, Norah Jones, just a few of the artists who have recorded the music of Townes Van Zandt, and now his old friend Steve Earle, a great songwriter in his own right, pays tribute to his mentor on his new record. It's called Townes, and it features Earle's versions of 15 songs from Townes Van Zandt, including White Freightliner Blues.
I'm going down on the highway, listen to them big trucks whine.
Steve Earle joins us from WNYC in New York. Steve, was this fun to put together, or maybe sad to put together, or maybe a little of both?
The idea was, a lot of people saw Townes the last 10 years of his life, because he actually toured more, and more people saw him, and more people heard of him the last 10 years of his life. But they didn't see what I saw when I first saw him when I was 17, because he was such a great performer then. So the record, my performances on this record are based on my memory of Townes performing these songs live.
Well, and for people who didn't see him, you know, first of all, picture a young, lanky guy with long, straight hair. He seemed to always look young. Cowboy hat. Texas, but we were thinking Texas, but through sort of a sepia prism. What would we have seen on stage? I mean, what was special about the stage as opposed to the recorded?
He was one of the best solo performers I ever saw. I've seen a few people that were as good. Steve Goodman was as good as Townes was as a solo performer. Loudon Wainwright is. But it's a rare thing. But Townes, he didn't do anything. He just walked up and closed his eyes and started singing, and it was riveting. And it set very high standards for me and the other people. I was a member of a cult. We were all completely and totally our lives, you know, revolved around Townes.
And given all that, what was it like when you actually first met him? Because, do I understand this right? You were playing a show, and he was in the audience.
A show is overstating it. I was playing the Old Quarter, where Townes is, you know, one of his best records is a live record that was made at the Old Quarter. But when I played there, there were six people there, one of whom was Townes. The club owner's dog had fallen in love right in front of the stage during my first set. And during the second set, Townes showed up, and he began heckling me. He never made a sound while I was actually singing. But then between songs, he kept asking me. Well, he didn't ask me. He would yell at me and, you know, demand that I play the Wabash Cannonball. And finally, I played a song of his that had a lot of words called Mr. Mud and Mr. Gold, and he shut up.
Did he really say to you, you call yourself a folk singer and you don't know Wabash?
He did. I was when I admitted. I said, man, I don't know the Wabash Cannonball. He said, you call yourself a folk singer and you don't know the Wabash Cannonball? Yeah, he did say that.
Well, that song, Mr. Mud and Mr. Gold, is on your new CD. You trade verses with your son, Justin Townes. Quite an honor, named your son after Townes. Let's listen to Mr. Mud, Mr. Gold.
The wicked king of clubs awoke. It was to his queen he turned. His lips were laughing as they spoke. His eyes like bullets burned. The sun's upon a gambling day. Queen smiled low and blissfully. Let's make some wretched fool to pay. And plain
that's Mr. Mud and Mr. Gold from Steve Earle's new CD, Townes, on which he covers 15 songs by the late songwriter Townes Van Zandt. And Steve, the first song on your CD is Poncho and Lefty. Safe to say that was Townes' signature song?
Yeah, the way he wrote, you know, people used to ask him about Poncho and Lefty, and he got so tired of it, he'd say, this song is about Billy Graham and the Guru Maharaji. You know, and it would be a different two guys that didn't have anything to do with each other every single time he introduced it.
Okay, so who is it about?
My theory is that all of these songs are about Townes.
Well, we know you have your guitar there. So can we hear Poncho and Lefty?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
Living on the road, my friend, is gonna keep you free and clean. And now you wear your skin like iron, and your breath is hard as kerosene. Weren't your mama's only boy, but a favorite one, it seems. As she began to cry when we said goodbye, Ponchos, bandit boys, his horse as fast as polished steel, wore his gun outside his pants for all the honest world to feel. Poncho met his match, you know, on the deserts down in Mexico. Nobody heard his dying words. All the Federalists say could hit him any day. We don't let him hang around out of kindness, I suppose. Let the cans and blues all night long like he used to. Dust Poncho bit down south and did up and left his mouth. The diddle poor Poncho low left his flipper Ohio, where he got the bread to go. There ain't nobody knows how the Federalists say could have hit him any day. We don't let him go so wrong. Out of kindness, I suppose. Poets tell how Poncho felt, left us living in a cheap hotel. The desert's quiet, Cleveland's cold. So the story ends, we're told. Poncho, need your prayers, it's true, but save a few for left to do. He only did what he had to do. And now he's growing old. All the Federalists say could have out of kindness, I suppose. A few great Federalists say we only had him in a day. We only let him slip away. Out of kindness, I suppose.
Later in the hour, we'll get back to the news, but we'll be back with Steve Earle in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Steve Earle about his new CD, Towns, which includes Earle's performances of 15 songs written by his mentor and friend, Towns Van Zandt.
I used to wake and run with the moon. I lived like a rake and a young man. Covered my lovers with flowers and wounds.
With songs like Rake, Towns Van Zandt inspired a generation of fellow Texas songwriters, including Willie Nelson and Guy Clark. And Steve Earle, before the break, you were saying that the song Poncho and Lefty really wasn't about a poncho or a lefty. It was really about Towns, and I wondered if you could talk about that a little more.
The purpose of art, as far as I can tell from making it for a while, is I feel successful when I use my own experience and the things that I know the most intimately, and I find the common ground between me and the audience, the things that I care about and they care about, or even when I can make somebody care about something they didn't care about before because I find our common ground. And Towns did that constantly by looking inward at himself and finding the parts of him that were universal, the parts of him that Towns was so good that you didn't even always know, you know, where he was touching you, you know, in the process of listening to his work.
Poncho and Lefty, a hit for Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard, but Towns never really had a hit record himself. In fact, I'm learning that he couldn't keep his records in print. Why not? What happened?
The company that put out his records wasn't particularly stable. And he didn't involve himself with the business aspects of it in any way, shape, or form. He trusted other people to do all that.
Yeah.
He thought his job was to write songs. And Towns also, I think it's really important to remember that I don't consider Towns to be a misunderstood genius. He was an alcoholic. There's no doubt about that. And he had maybe some other stuff going on, but he was also one of the best songwriters I ever saw. And all those are completely separate issues.
Yeah.
You know, I had the same disease that Towns died of, and I didn't die of it. Why is that? You know, there's a certain amount of survivor's guilt involved in this project. Why didn't it get me, and why did I make more money than he did? Why do I make more money than a lot of the people that taught me how to do this? And but that's the way it is, and I'm not in charge of it. So it's one of those things. I do believe, and I witnessed Towns shooting himself in the foot almost constantly.
You almost witnessed him shooting himself elsewhere.
I know, but that really pissed me off.
I was going to ask about that.
It was one of those things. It made me really angry. And
Russian roulette. I mean, let's say it, you know, and he was drinking. And it's tough if you love someone to see him do that.
Yeah, and it was one of those things. It was sort of a punctuation mark for a while after that. I mean, I saw him, but I never drank with him again. And this was long before I quit drinking and quit taking drugs, but I never drank with him again.
Well, you wouldn't be the first person to be really mad at, you know, somebody who was drinking or drugging or, you know, playing Russian roulette while drunk. But, you know, you say that there's a little bit of survivor's guilt to the making of the CD. And yet, you know, also joy, also, you know, hearing all this music together, you know, you've got a son named after him. I'm just wondering, you know.
I mean, when I called him the day Justin was born, you know, that's a really example of the best things about Towns. He was way too humble when it came to his opinion of himself as a human being. And he knew how good he was. He knew he was Towns Van Zandt. And he knew that he deserved to be mentioned in the same, you know, sentence as Bob Dylan. But he also constantly sabotaged, you know, that. Mm. I don't know why. There was a part of him that didn't think that he was worthy of anything. But when I called him and told him that you know, I said, I got a boy. And he said, cool. And I said, his name, he said, what's his name? And I said, Justin Towns Earl. And there was just dead silence on the other end of the line. And then he said, is that after anybody in my family? And I didn't know anybody else in Towns' family. So it was kind of a silly question.
That's Steve Earle. His new CD pays tribute to Towns Van Zandt. It's called simply Towns. Steve, as we go, can you play one more song for us? And if you get to pick, so which would it be?
Let's do Lungs, just because.
Lungs.
This song, in Towns' songbook, he said, there are little notes at the top where it normally says Italian things at the top of the sheet music.
Right.
And then, but in Towns' notation, it said, for this song should be screamed. Oh, won't you lend your lungs to me? Mine are collapsing. Plan my feet and bitterly breathe up the time that's passing. Breath I take and breath I give. Pray the day ain't poison. Stand among the ones that live in lonely indecision. Our fingers walk the darkness down. Mine is on midnight. Gather up the gold you found. You fools on the moonlight. If you try and take it home, your hands are turned to butter. Better leave his dream alone, try and find another. So
Salvation said and crossed herself and called the devil partner. Wisdom burned upon a ship who killed a raging cancer. Sealed the river at its mouth, take the waters prisoner. Fill the skies with screams and cries, bathing fiery answer. Concept. Strangers crying foreign tongues dirty up a doorstep. And I for one of you for two ain't got time for outside. I'll kick y'all in your lust for you. We'll tell the world that we tried.
Steve Earle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In sports, the National Hockey League Conference Finals are set. In the East, it will be the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Charlotte Hurricanes, who beat the Boston Bruins in overtime last night. In the West, the Detroit Red Wings sent the Anaheim Ducks packing and now face off against the Chicago Blackhawks. In the NBA, the Orlando Magic beat the Boston Celtics last night. It was a bad night for Boston, forcing a deciding Eastern Conference semifinal game on Sunday. In the West, the Los Angeles Lakers and Houston Rockets face off in their Game 7, also on Sunday. So where will former NBA superstar Larry Bird be on Sunday? At school. The Boston Celtic legend is going to be back in Boston this weekend to pick up an honorary doctorate of letters from Boston University. And he joins us now from his office at the Indiana Pacers headquarters, where he's president of basketball operations, soon to be Dr. Bird. Welcome.
Good morning.
Do you have one of these? Do you have a doctorate?
No, I've sort of put it off until I got older because I had opportunities, but a great honor.
But I'm thinking President Obama didn't even get his honorary doctorate the other night in Arizona. They said he didn't have a body of work yet, and here you're getting one.
Oh, boy, come a long way, huh?
Well, and what would you want to say to young people today? You know, you were at Indiana State. Is there something you wished someone had told you and that you would want to impart to a young person today?
Well, it's like my mother said in high school, you know, right now I don't mean that much to you, but as you go on in life, your high school education is one of the most important things. And have an opportunity to go to college, which she didn't have that opportunity, but I had an opportunity to go to college. And, you know, my last couple of years I got pretty serious about it because I knew I was going to move on and didn't know where I was going to live, but I knew I had an opportunity to play basketball. And fortunately for me, I got to go to Boston, and Boston's a great city, and learned a lot.
Right. Well, I'm wondering, too, if you might also tell them you might lose a big game now, you know, in college, but it won't matter down the road, or, you know, you'll win bigger ones down the road, because I'm thinking, of course, of the, you know, it's been 30 years since you and Magic Johnson had the NCAA face-off.
Robin, it hurts just as much today.
It does, okay.
So.
Forget that. Forget that advice. Well, what about the basketball that's being played today? We're assuming you're going to be rooting for, well, maybe I shouldn't assume. Are you rooting for the Celtics? And how do you think they're going to do without star forward Kevin Garnett?
Well, I always root for Boston. You know, when we play against them, obviously I root against them. But, you know, they had a great year last year. They were the best team. And you know, when you don't have your best players and they've had some injuries, it's very tough. But they continue to compete. I watched the game last night. They had every opportunity to win that one. But, you know, they've got to regroup, and there's nothing like a Game 7 in the NBA playoffs. And hopefully they'll come around and get the win.
Well, the Orlando Magic did, you know, claw their way back. But no matter who takes that series, they have to overcome the Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James. They've been resting since Monday after dispensing with the Atlanta Hawks. What do you think, by the way, of players like James? People are starting to compare him to greats like you and Magic Johnson.
Well, LeBron's got a different skill set than I have. You know, he's got the quickness and the jumping ability. But we play basically the same game. We try to keep our teammates involved. And if it comes down to the last few seconds, you always want the ball in your hands. And he does the same thing. But, you know, he's a great player. I got a lot of admiration for him and Kobe Bryant, some of the better players in the league, just the way they handle themselves and how they continue to try to get their teammates involved.
Well, Kobe Bryant from the L.A. Lakers, they struggled. They lost last night to the Houston Rockets. They could be out of it. But I'm just wondering, you said LeBron James had different skill sets from you. Just remind us, what do you think your skill was?
Well, you know, my ability to get the ball to people in the right spots, to lead, to hit shots when they count the most, try to keep the guys together even though you might lose a big game, come back the next day with the fire and the desire to perform at a higher level. So it's, you know, it's all a game, but still it was our lives and it was our job, and you get paid for winning, and winning's everything.
Yeah. That's former Celtic great Larry Bird, soon to be Doctor of Letters when he receives his honorary degree from Boston University this weekend. Larry, congratulations, but I'm really trying to figure it out. I mean, you never call, you never write Doctor of Letters?
No, I don't. I email every once in a while and text, so that's a start.
Larry, congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
It's really not bad for the guy who described himself as the Hick from French Lick. Back in a bit, here and now. We all know that physical violence in a home will literally and figuratively scar the children living there. But what about arguing, verbal fisticuffs? How bad can that be for kids? Well, according to the results of a study that began more than 30 years ago, much worse than you might think. In fact, verbal fighting affects children almost as much as physical violence does. Helen Reinhertz is a professor of social work at Simmons College here in the Boston area. She's also the lead researcher in the Quincy study, which began in 1976. It's named after a town here in Massachusetts where the research took place. Professor Reinhertz joins us and tell us, you tracked more than 300 kids, starting from when they were in kindergarten up through age 30. And the most recent finding, published in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, looks at how verbal arguing during adolescence affects kids well into adulthood. What'd you find?
Well, we found that it had really considerable effect at age 30. For example, they were almost three times more at risk for having major depression than those who did not have the increased arguments. They were almost four times more likely to have alcohol abuse dependence.
And also understand they were more likely to be unemployed at 30 if they told you at 15 that there was a lot of verbal fighting in the house. How did they compare to kids who had physical fighting in the house?
Well, it was a smaller group, thank goodness, that experienced physical violence. And this was even more scarring, but not excessively more. For example, here we found more alcohol abuse dependence, a four-time risk rather than three times greater risk. We found drug abuse dependence. We found more examples of feeling poorly about themselves, lower self-esteem in this group, lower life satisfaction, which was in both groups, but greater in the physical violence group. So both groups did have problems in later life. But what surprised us was the extent of the problems that the group that experienced only the verbal and not the physical.
Yeah, because you're saying that it wasn't that much difference between the group that had the physical violence.
That is true.
And the verbal.
The greatest disadvantage of the physical violence group was in the drug abuse dependence and in their poorer physical health.
Well, but in terms of the verbal abuse, according to a researcher quoted in a Boston Globe article, it's not just yelling. It's parents saying things to kids like, I wish you'd never been born, or name-calling. And I want to touch on the many letters to the editor after that article on your study's findings. One reader commented, we need a 30-year study to conclude this. It's sort of like saying that a 30-year study shows that if you plant corn in rows, you get rows of corn, he says. But you say that a study like yours can actually lead to intervention.
Yes, I hope so. You know, there are very happily increasing programs teaching parenting skills, programs dealing with ways of parent-child communication, and it's really important, particularly in the adolescent years.
Well, and for those parents who say, oh, but I have feelings, I have to get them out, you and other researchers aren't saying don't stop disagreeing with your partner, but just don't fight in front of the kids?
I think if one can avoid it, it certainly is a good idea, because it is putting the adolescent in a really tough spot. I mean, who do I protect, agree with? So if the adults can avoid that, that's great. on top of that, it's really important for those who deal with kids, either in schools or in, you know, in sports, and when they see a child who seems to be having some difficulty, that they try to get help for the family.
That's Helen Reinhurst. She's professor of social work at Simmons College School of Social Work here in the Boston area. She's been the lead researcher in the Quincy study since it began in 1976, and their latest finding that verbal fighting in the home really has a negative impact on kids when they get older. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, let's take a few minutes now to hear from some of you. This week, we took a look at faith-based wars. Ressa Aslan, author of How to Win a Cosmic War, said that Muslim jihadists are fighting a religious war, but some American evangelicals are fighting one as well. Ressa cites tanks in Iraq with slogans like the New Testament tank. Well, Charles Amel from Lenexa, Kansas writes, I was in the military for 4 years, and I don't recall there being any of that kind of evangelizing. And after we spoke with Franco Sacchi, whose documentary Waiting for Armageddon features evangelicals who believe world events are playing out a biblical prophecy, we heard from Dr. Stephen Leston of DeKalb, Illinois, who wrote, as an evangelical, I reject the theology expressed in the film. This is not an evangelical position. It's actually what's called a dispensational position. Therefore, what I ask of you is to call these people dispensationalists rather than evangelicals. Well, Dr. Leston will consider that. Reporter Rachel Gottbaum's new public radio documentary is called Quality of Death, End of Life Care. She spoke with us about palliative care, someone to guide patients and families after a serious diagnosis, often steering them away from futile procedures. Well, Victoria Murphy of Matthews, North Carolina, is one of many respiratory therapists who wrote to say, thank you, thank you. I see the struggles every day. The doctors and nurses from palliative medicine are the most caring and intelligent caregivers. But John Williams of Ashland, Oregon, listened in concern. He writes, as a patient advocate, my widespread experience is in stark contrast to what reporter Rachel Gottbaum found. Clearly, palliative care has an important place, but I'm concerned about increasing pressure for patients to forego viable treatment. Hearing patients kept alive with restraints and barbaric tactics surely makes a graphic story, but watching a seriously ill patient die, especially a young person, simply because their doctors are not aware of treatment options or have a bias towards palliative care is truly sickening. And Dr. Ron Weintraub, a former surgeon and currently a professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, had a concern as well, so we called him up. Dr. Weintraub, you felt that the statistic we used, that 30% of Medicare expenses were in the last year of life, implied that doctors were what, knowingly doing futile surgery? Explain.
The problem is there's no method to predict months or weeks in advance who's going to live and who's going to die. So it's difficult to know in advance what costs are for care at the end of life and what costs are for actually saving a life.
In other words, as a doctor, you're not always convinced it's the last year of life.
Well, that's absolutely true. There are some patients, you know, the likelihood of that patient living for 12 months is small, but there are a lot of other equally ill patients that you have to treat because you don't know if that's the last year of life. In fact, they may walk out of the hospital and be perfectly happy and productive citizens.
Dr. Weintraub, thanks so much.
Okay.
And finally, Kurt Proctor weighed in from Ohio about the new Star Trek movie after we spoke with Klingon language creator Mark Okrand. Kurt seems like a tortured fan. He writes, 40 years ago, I used to sneak down the stairs, sit on the landing, and listen to Star Trek as my parents watched below. I just saw the new movie, and it made me realize how deep a Trekkie I am, because I cannot accept the new alternate timeline. Unless the next movie restores the timeline, I can't consider myself a Star Trek fan anymore. But I have to say, the visual effects were great. I love the new Enterprise, and the new cast nailed the characters. Just please, in future movies, don't prostitute Star Trek. Well, if you have thoughts on anything on the program, email us at letters@hereandnow.org or call 617-358-0397. Back in a minute, Here and Now. We'll be right back.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Anyone who was anyone was at the theater in Paris on the night of May 19, 1909, when the Ballet Russe of Russian expat impresario Serge Diaghilev gave its first performance. The great Vaslav Nijinsky apparently leapt so high the audience gasped. No one had seen dance or theater like it. And to this day, the opening night of the Ballet Russe is heralded as the birth of modern ballet. Well, this month, ballet companies and scholars worldwide are celebrating the 100th anniversary of Diaghilev's Ballet Russe because Diaghilev, a wealthy art critic and patron, not only reinvented ballet, he also created a hugely influential artistic movement by bringing in the most visionary and avant-garde artists of the day. Here and Now's Lynn Manigan recently spent some time at the Boston Ballet with conductor Jonathan McPhee as the ballet was rehearsing Afternoon of a Faun, a 1912 Diaghilev ballet, which was set to the flowing music of Claude Debussy, choreographed and danced by Nijinsky, and, like other Diaghilev ballets, caused something of a riot at its premiere.
It was a real involvement that the audience had in their participatory sport. Diaghilev things really became the hot intellectual thing to go. Everybody had to be there. Everybody had to have an opinion. And people came prepared to either like it or not like it, to be shocked.
In fact, Diaghilev had a motto, which was...
Astonish me. Yep. Something new. Something from a new way of thinking. That's why he got people like Picasso involved in set design. Eric Satie, who always was his own musical force and would do things that no one would had ever conceived of. I mean, putting roulette wheels in the orchestra and so that you get guns, typewriters, you know, all these things that normally wouldn't go together to say something that hadn't been said before. And Faun, here we had this piece that Debussy had written several years earlier, which had already established itself as being, you know, a wonderful new kind of composition.
Very lush.
Yeah, it was misty and dreamy, and so you would expect to come and see a piece that was misty and dreamy and luscious and filled with great romantic flowing movement. Instead, you get this deer. You get these weird nymphs that have hopped off of vase.
Yes, that's right. The knee low is better. Close your fingers, dear.
Former Paris Opera Ballet star Guylaine Temar coached dancers Roman Reikin and Josephine Prah as they prepared to dance the roles of the Faun and the Nymph in Boston Ballet's Afternoon of a Faun.
But you can also take the flute, you know, there. You can also take the flute there, which is not bad because it keeps you busy. And you will drop it when she comes in.
As the curtain rises, take it. Faun is seated on a rock, in profile like on a Greek vase, holding a flute and gobbling up grapes. A nymph enters, also in profile. She drops her shawl to bathe.
Oh, take all your time, Josephine, that's right. Open, yes, that's right. Slowly. Now you smell. Slowly turn the body. See her.
What's striking with Afternoon of the Faun is the fact that it's one thing to say, turn your head left, turn your head right, move your hand to the right, move it up, move it down. It's another thing to say, okay, your head has to move in jerky motions because you're not human. Or the lift of your chin as you move your head to the side has to do with sniffing. So that you smell her as the Faun before you actually see the nymph. And it's a very different way of doing things for the dancers. I mean, even today, it is rare that you become something that is not human on the ballet stage. Anytime they became dancer human beings, she'd say, no, you're not human. And I think that's part of what was misunderstood on the opening day.
and then you push away by looking at him. And then you go, 1, 2, 3, 4. Now he captures you.
In four sudden big steps, the fawn traps her.
That's right. And you love there. You love the first time. You're amused. You're amused by her. And then you start attacking a little bit, which is not easy.
And then there's this little scene here where he spots the one who's been taking a bath, and now suddenly she becomes real human because she realizes, looking at him, that she's naked. So she has to go over and pick up her shawl, and she covers her nakedness, and you see her sort of back around this fawn, who then does what real fawns do, which is throw his head back and bare his teeth like a laugh. And it frightens her. She starts to back away and drops her shawl. So then the fawn comes over and he picks up the shawl and he walks up the rock and then makes love to the shawl.
He apparently lies on this scarf.
Yes,
and
he does. And apparently, he throws his head back and there's it's pretty clear what's going on there. But that created an enormous scandal in Paris. And immediately the critic said, you know, this is gross, this is horrible. How could you possibly do this kind of profane thing on stage? Well, that actually did become part of the Diaghilev formula because he realized that controversy also sells tickets. So here we had Colette, I think his name was, who wrote the review in Paris that just lambasted the whole ballet. Auguste Rodin, the sculptor, countered that with supporting the whole thing. And, of course, I would expect a sculptor of Rodin's stature who appreciated in, you know, three-dimensional forms the real passion that's hidden within them. And that's exactly what he saw. And he said, no, this is brilliant. You know, it's never been seen before, but the emotional impact of this lush music has come through with this movement that's so opposite what we expect. One thing we have to continue to do is preserve the things that he created. And remember, Diaghilev was not a musician, nor was he a dancer, nor was he a choreographer, but he was an entrepreneur. He was a person who knew how art of any kind affects a human being, and therefore was able to draw and sort of put the right combinations together. His hit list was actually pretty great. Diaghilev changed the orchestral world forever with the things he created. He changed the art world. He educated the people because they were getting crossover influences in art and literature and dance and music, and gave opportunities for some of the cutting-edge composers, Prokofiev, Stravinsky, Erik Satie, to let their imaginations run wild and really create.
Boston Ballet conductor Jonathan McPhee speaking with Here and Now's Lynn Menegon. For more information about Diaghilev celebrations, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful weekend, and please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.